Leancast, product innovation and UX design with Bonanza Design.
What's up, everybody? Leancast again, another episode. I'm here with John Smailoglu. He is the guy you want to reach out to if you're running a startup, if you are dealing with risk, if you are thinking about launching new ventures, if you are an up-and-coming entrepreneur and have some ideas in mind and you want to understand the full scope of risk concerning your ideas, he is, ladies and gentlemen, he is the insurance guru of Berlin.
Yes.
The one and only. John is here with me. John, how are you feeling? Thank you for squeezing in this podcast in your busy schedule. Talk to me, please.
Well, obviously happy to be here, Berhad. I mean, the sun is shining in Berlin, so you know that's always a good thing. As we slowly start heading into this 6 month long gray season, but beyond that, always a pleasure to chop it up with you. Happy to be here, and let's see what we get into today. Very curious.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this one because I want to talk to you about risk.
Yes.
The verb of today's world. What is risk?
God, there's so many ways to look at it. But, you know, if we're talking about the startup ecosystem, risk is at the core of, I think, every single venture, right? Mm-hmm. And when I look at founders and what they get into, it's really them positioning themselves as professional risk takers. that's really what they're doing. And when you look at these initiatives, a lot of them are crazy and absurd when you compare it to traditional businesses. And that's what makes it exciting. So without risk, there would be no startup ecosystem. So there's that part to it, which is great and allows for all of these crazy ideas to come to life. But at the same time, it's something that can also derail and devastate a business if you don't, number one, understand your risks, and number two, take the proper measures to minimize the risk as much as possible. I think it's impossible to completely get rid of it, but there's a lot you can do to bring it down to a very low level.
Know thyself. I think that's a very famous expression. Everyone has heard it before. Mm-hmm. You said something really interesting. Understand your risk. Talk to me more about this, please.
Yeah, I mean, when you form a business, there's mm-hmm. there's risk. It exists. I don't care what activities you're involved in, what vertical you're on, there's risk. So you need to look at, okay, what am I doing as a business? Am I exposing my company, my employees, and my clients to these risks? And just understanding, okay, this is something that needs to be mitigated. I need to protect my company. How do I do that? So let's talk about one risk that's pretty popular nowadays, cyber risk, right? Everyone knows what it means, but what do you do to protect yourself? I mean, there's a variety of ways you can do that. Number one, understanding how you can set up certain cybersecurity measures to protect. Number two, ongoing monitoring to make sure those systems are actually working and up to date with threats that are changing all the time. So those I would broadly categorize them as proactive measures. And then you have reactive measures like insurance, which is what I work on, where in the event something happens, then you have a tool that'll help you get back on your feet from a financial standpoint and guide you mm-hmm. the process of, okay, let's solve this problem. Let's get rid of it so that we can get back to work and focus on doing what's most important, which is running the business.
What are the reactive measures that startups need to hire, employ to protect their ventures from harms?
Insurance, of course. I mean, that's one of the main tools to help with financial risk mitigation, if we want to get really, mm-hmm. that's really what it does. So if a startup is faced with a scenario where they're being sued or if mm-hmm. a claim being brought against them from a client. There's costs associated with that, right? Mm-hmm. You need to defend yourself. You need a lawyer. You need someone to investigate the claim, et cetera, et cetera. And for startups, especially those that are early stage, this can be a problem because they may not necessarily have the funds and or resources to do this. So how do you do that? You know, instead of having to pay an attorney, whatever it is, 300-500 euros an hour, have an insurance policy that takes care of that for you. So not only does it help with the cost, but it also helps with the experience. You know, you have a team, you have experienced, dedicated people to help you get through that turbulent period. So when you look at reactive measures, I always say insurance should be your last line of defense. Don't just go into the business world thinking insurance is the end all be all. It's not. There's a lot of things that you can do beforehand. And I'll touch on that because it's really important for startups. When you're making, for example, deals with your clients, normally the first line of defense is the type of contractual agreement you have with them, right? What are the terms? What are the conditions? Who's responsible for what? Who's responsible for liability? Are you relieving yourself of any liability? And that's really where you begin. So if something does go wrong, then you can refer to this piece of paper and say, hey, look, you know, these are the conditions that we outlined as part of our partnership. And oftentimes it works, oftentimes it doesn't. It really depends on the situation, right? How severe is the claim? How greedy are the lawyers on the other side? Do they not care about your contract and just want to bring you straight to court? So you start there, and then if that doesn't work, then your backup is insurance. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is that the founders need to be educated enough to understand what are the liabilities around their business.
Correct.
And reflect or address those liabilities in the engagement that they are putting themselves into with other businesses. So that's the first line of defense.
Absolutely, is awareness, right? Understanding, mm-hmm. understanding what it's about. And in dealing with founders, it's interesting. So first time founders, they know it's something they need to do. It's somewhere on their list. It's usually right below waterboarding. That's how attractive the topic of insurance is with these startups. And when you look at second time founders, they are more proactive. They actually take the steps to make sure that they're properly set up. And that's mainly due to a variety of reasons. I think one is going back to awareness. They now understand the importance of it. Or mm-hmm. they've been in a situation where they should have had insurance and they didn't, or they had insurance and it really saved their assets. So awareness mm-hmm. is the first part, right? Knowing that you need it. But it goes a bit deeper than that. And again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier is looking at your business and really understanding, okay, what risks are there? What can hit us at this particular stage that would derail our efforts, and how to protect mm-hmm. ourselves against that? So it's not only just understanding the risk, it's also understanding the risk relevant to you at that particular time in your business, because risk always changes. It's not the same. You know, two people in a basement working on an idea, the risk profile there is very different versus when they grow into a company that has 500 employees. So it's a matter of continuously being on top of it and having the right people around you to help you understand what it means.
So risk profile, I want to chop it down, means that at every given stage of your growth, there are certain risks that are more relevant or more probable to occur because of the nature of your growth and business, right?
Yeah, I mean, if we want to talk about something very basic, when you're two people, you probably just have two laptops. When you have 500 people, you have 500 pieces of equipment, right? So the risk of loss grows, right? If there were to be a total loss or a severe scenario, then now you're dealt with a situation where more things need to be replaced. It also goes in line with the types of clients you deal with. I mean, if you're picking up an enterprise client, that is a totally different game versus a tiny company. And oftentimes, as part of those enterprise agreements, insurance is mandatory. In other words, you will not get that client unless you have certain types of policies, mainly liability, financial loss liability, and certain policy limits. So it's one thing to have the coverage. Second is, what does that coverage look like? And if you want to be doing business on that level, it's certainly going to come up without a doubt.
How do you go about, because, you know, the nature of insurance is a bit, it doesn't have a good reputation. But the thing is, as soon as something happens to you, you're like, why didn't I have insurance?
Very true.
Right? So it's bad until it happens to you. Then it becomes, I really need an insurance. How do you go about, and I know it can be frustrating talking to someone that the need for that product is not there in their awareness. How do you go about talking to first-time founders about protecting yourself, protecting your business?
Very, very, very good question. So to go back to your first statement, yeah, insurance people have the reputation of used car salesmen and snake oil salesmen. So it's an unfortunate thing, but it is a bit of a tarnished image that we have. And that's due to a variety of things. I mean, I can relate it to sort of when you go to a mechanic, right? People usually think mechanics are shady. They're trying to pull a fast one on them. And that's because the consumer doesn't know anything about fixing a car, right? They're completely in the dark. So when you don't know something about a subject and someone's throwing all these problems at you and costs associated with it, you're a bit hesitant. You don't know what's going on. And I think insurance is the same. It's a very complex, cumbersome thing where the average business person just doesn't really understand the ins and outs of it. And that causes some confusion. So we start on that foot, meaning people don't trust us. They're confused. And that's probably why they don't want to get into it. Again, they know they need to do it, but they're just not running to me with open arms saying, hey, insure me. So how do you get around that? Well, trust. I mean, trust is the number one element without a doubt. But how do you gain trust and how do you portray that to people who want to work with you? And I think it falls on reputation, right? The startup ecosystem is a close-knit community. It's smaller than we think it is. Many people know each other. And by doing the right thing for your people, for your clients, and taking care of them in a proper fashion, word mm-hmm. starts getting out. So I feel the best form of marketing is happy clients. And if you've established yourself and you've made a name within a certain ecosystem, people will know, okay, he's the one to go to for this. He's the one to go to for that. And LinkedIn has also been very, very helpful in getting the word out there, getting my message out there, establishing myself as an expert on certain subjects, mainly insurance. And it takes time. Founders, again, they know they need to do it. And where I found my success is getting in early with them. In other words, mm-hmm. before they even incorporate as a business, and just first connecting with them as a human, not as an insurance salesperson.
Yeah.
It's super important. People like to work with people they like, myself included. I like to work with clients who I enjoy. And it's sort of this natural transition into, I like you, you're a cool dude, you're knowledgeable, let's work together. That's what mm-hmm. worked for me. And that's how I've been able to connect with a lot of founders.
Something you mentioned about a two founder in the garage startup goes to or scales up to a 500 people startups. Everyone has laptops. I would envision or like I would assume that with the advent of remote work situation, now the risk profile of such mass startups that are growing really fast has expanded so much, because now there are, before you would have your laptops, you would predominantly have your laptops in the offices. Work done, you leave the laptop, you go home. Mm-hmm. So everything would be under one server, yeah, so to speak. Talk to me a bit about remote, corona pandemic, remote work, and sort of like a risk profiles of startups. How did remote work affect businesses? Was it negative? Was it positive in terms of risk?
Different. It could be negative and positive. So when you look at pre-pandemic, when most people were going into an office, working their 9 to 5 and then going home, like you said, that's a different risk profile. And, you know, in that sort of a setting, you have potentially more risk than compared to people working remotely. Why? Because if you have a lot of foot traffic in the office, especially with clients coming in and other individuals, that creates a certain type of risk versus people working from home and being spread out and not being in one confined office space, if you will. So remote work has been interesting because it's new, relatively new, at least to the archaic insurance industry. And some carriers were quick to react on it and understand, okay, we need to do something about this. And others have pretty much kept their products the same. So it's interesting to see how it'll pan out in the future. Remote is here to stay, in my opinion. I don't think it's going anywhere. And then we also add in the new gig economies that have come out with the pandemic and people leaving fixed jobs and sort of doing their own thing and becoming freelancers. So now we're looking at a variety of different risk profiles.
Gig economy was a big trend in pandemic?
Meaning, I think people realize they don't have to necessarily work for a company. And even if they do, they can do certain side gigs,
right,
for additional income. Because at the beginning, there was a lot of question marks in people's minds. Like, what's going to happen with the economy? Is my job secure? Mm-hmm. Is my income going to stay there? I think this opened people's eyes to, okay, I may have to consider alternative or additional types of work for more money. And plus, when you have startups whose business models are based on this, it also opens up people to the idea of, hey, you know, if I'm a student, for example, I don't necessarily have to get a job that has fixed hours. I can work when I have the time. And it's certainly been growing. I mean, we see this in the delivery space, for example, and there's other platforms where if you have a certain skill, you can share that skill on that platform and have someone hire you on an ad hoc basis. So it's in the grand scheme of things, it's relatively new. And I do believe the pandemic fueled this economy, making it a bit bigger.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that, you know, because, yeah, pandemic sort of eye-opener for me too as well, John. Bonanza Design is the product, is the result of corona pandemic. I don't know if you know the story. I had the name of the brand for a while, since middle of 2019. I never dared to get behind it fully. And a business is not a business unless the founders put their 100% behind
it. For sure.
It's clear to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I see a lot of solopreneurs and it's like, hey, what are you doing? I'm an entrepreneur. I'm doing this. And I'm cool. That's cool. Also working part-time for another. No, that's not it. You haven't risked completely. You haven't taken the risk completely. Yeah. You're just like sort of in between. I was sort of in between till April 2020. I finished my last freelance gig. So usually get brought in to project by other innovation studios, agencies, what have you. And then, you know, I would get the job done out after 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I would get another one. So that was like the rhythm behind my rhythm before corona pandemic. Corona pandemic happened, radio silence all around me for about a month
yeah.
till like May, and I changed colors, went through different stages of denial, anger, resentment, what have you. And then I realized, like, no, that's not it. I have to really, like, you know, stand up and fight for my financial and creative freedom. Absolutely. That's because I didn't see any other way, to be honest. That was like out of pure desperation.
Very true. I mean, it opened people's eyes in more ways than we could have imagined. And job security, I think, became a topic for a lot of people in their minds because it was a big question mark. Nobody knew which way things were heading, what impact it was going to have economically. And here we are, fast forward a year and a half, 2 years later, in a similar situation, right? We have recession looming over our head, and maybe it was good we went through that during the pandemic. It was a bit of a mental workout to be able to prepare for what's coming. And you know what's coming? Nobody knows. I mean, it's a big question mark. So kind of back to where we were, and very curious to see how things are going to play out.
Do you see more tendency towards getting new insurance policies in such high turbulent times? What's the general consumption tendency?
What happens first is insurance now becomes top of mind for a lot of clients because they need to think, okay, things don't look so hot. If something happens, how are we protected? And it really depends on the business. So if we look at the restaurant businesses, for example, during the pandemic, a lot of them didn't wind up so well. And what that really means from an insurance standpoint is, okay, what can I do to reduce my costs? Mm-hmm. And being proactive as an insurance provider and reaching out to them and saying, hey, look, okay, we know things are not looking good. How is it specific to you? Okay, now we understand your situation. This is what we should do to your coverage portfolio, which can mean reducing coverage, eliminating coverage. And again, it goes back to risk, right? So what's the real risk at this time? If you're not doing business at 100%, then your risk is probably going to go low. Then we can sort of adjust to reflect that. It also opened the way for new types of coverage ideas or modifications to existing policies, because nobody really would consider buying coverage for pandemics before the pandemic happened. Very few would do that. The ones who did were great, and it was important for them because it pays for business loss, right? Business interruption. But now all of a sudden it's on everybody's mind, and we get that question a lot. Well, if another corona pandemic happens, are we covered? So it definitely changes the mindset of people.
That's interesting. You know, a person in your position, I think you need to be able to understand the mechanism behind the business, the dynamic of a business, the DNA of the business, the sort of like a, you need to understand the business model. You need to understand, you need to be a bit of a psychologist to understand who you are dealing with, who are these founders are. So I feel like you most certainly offer more feedback than just a pure insurance. Like here's a product that might fit you. So I would like to tap into your experience dealing, especially with early stage founders. What kind of typical patterns you're seeing amongst them? What kind of mistakes they are making? What kind of, I think this, consider this as a sort of an open-ended question. Take it away. Like, what are the typical patterns we see amongst early stage founders?
There's a lot. But going back to how you started the question, it really does heavily fall on understanding them.
Yeah.
Okay. So in insurance, there's a lot who deal with commercial insurance, meaning they provide coverage for businesses. But that's more for typical standard traditional businesses, not startups, which we all know are nothing like standard businesses. So what does that translate to? The industry as a whole, or those who provide services in the industry, don't understand startups. That's where the disconnect begins. They treat them as regular businesses, they think the risks don't change a lot. And the type of coverage and service and consultation they get reflects that, meaning a lot of times it's not a correct match, right? So if I go and open up a bakery, it's pretty clear what my risks are. It's not really going to change unless I quadruple in size. But for the most part, that doesn't happen with that type of business. Whereas with a startup, things change day to day, hour to hour. You don't know what's going to happen. You can pivot, have a completely different risk. You can grow quickly. You can also shrink quickly. And you need to be dynamic in understanding those needs. So being able to understand that is crucial. And that's the first step. All right. The second step is, what other value do I bring to these founders? Right. Mm-hmm. What do I do besides insurance that's going to help their business grow and or help them manage their business? So protecting them is crucial. That's the core of what I do. But it goes beyond that, meaning when I understand, like you said, the DNA of their business, that also opens up the door to, okay, what challenges are we facing at this point? What do we need help with? How can we grow? How can we maintain this business? And in understanding that, it's a matter of, okay, I'm going to plug you into these resources, whether it's other individuals, other companies, whatever they need to overcome those challenges, I bring that to the table. So that's super crucial. When we look at patterns, I mean, I think founders, for the most part, they follow a similar path, right? They have an idea. Then they need to find the plan to realize that idea and how they can make it a reality. Then most importantly, the people. Who are the people behind this? Who's going to run it and make this thing actually successful? And then certain natural things follow. If they're going to go the VC route, which most startups do, angel, seed, pre-seed, seed, et cetera, investors, they do that. But helping them understand, hey, you're risking a lot. You're going to go on this crazy journey with its ups and downs, which is truly an emotional roller coaster because I see it all the time. You really need to protect yourself, not as a company, but also as a founder, so that you have that peace of mind so that you can focus on what's important, which is mainly two things: growing the business and fundraising.
I could see how uncomfortable these conversations could be for them. Like, because I'm a founder too, and you know, founders often are hot-headed and
or delusional.
Or delusional, that's true too. So dealing with these kind of personalities is often difficult to say, hey, I know you're above the skies, flying high, but you need to be grounded on reality. You need to have some anchors that could, you know, save you if when there is stormy weather. Do you get a lot of rejection? Do you get a lot of like, I know, da 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 da?
I do. It's funny when the subject of insurance comes up, because all of a sudden, the person sitting across from me knows more than me. Meaning, oh, I don't do that. That'll never happen. Or no, my friend told me that they don't. Well, I mean, you don't go to the butcher to buy shoes. It's just, you don't do that. So it does happen. And I understand where they're coming from, right? Again, it goes back to the whole trust element. They don't necessarily think that the insurance industry is the most trustworthy. There's a bit of, I don't want to say hesitation, but questions in their mind in terms of, is this person really going to do what's in my best interest? Or are they going to think of, let me sell them the most insurance I possibly can so that I can get the biggest commission check? And that's the reality, unfortunately. So there is a bit of pushback, but when you're able to form, again, it goes back to relationships and just keeping it human to human. There's a certain point after you meet someone, you know, okay, this is someone that I want to work with. This is someone who is really looking out for my best interest. And once you establish that bond and they see you as, number one, that, and secondly, as, okay, this guy knows his stuff when it comes to insurance, they listen to you. And the approach that has worked best for me is being very transparent and saying, look, yeah. this is what you need now. You don't need to buy 16 different insurance policies. And unfortunately, I have clients that come to me who already have coverage. I look at their portfolio and I'm like, why do you have all this stuff? Well, the guy told me I needed it and I purchased it. Wrong. Absolutely wrong. It needs to reflect the stage that you're in at this particular time with an understanding of 3, 6, 9, 12 months down the road, things are projected to go this way. And then you adjust the risk to match that.
Out of curiosity, John, so you're sort of at the, you know, I know John, of course, from, it's not our first encounter. So I don't know if you know, he is big on LinkedIn. He's one of the most creative content marketers I know. So he's not only an insurer. And he's an entrepreneur, first and foremost. So it's sort of like I have curiosity in my curiosity is, have you tempted to invest in any of these early stage startups that you bump into them?
From a financial standpoint? No, not yet.
Yeah.
But from a standpoint where I'm investing time into help them understanding what'll help their business efforts and educating them, I've invested a lot, without a doubt. And these are good investments. These are long-term investments, meaning I'm planting seeds that I'll probably see the fruits of 1, 2, 3 years later down the road. And that's important because a lot of people, and I get it, look, we're all in business to make money. Unless you're doing a charity, we're here to make money. But sometimes you need to pass on that instant gratification in order to set up an infrastructure or a base where you'll be super successful a few years down the road. And that's my investment in terms of time and energy has been mainly that way for the first 2 years that I stepped into the startup ecosystem here in Berlin.
How long have you been here active?
How long have I been active in the insurance industry here?
In Berlin startup
scene. Berlin startup scene, it's coming up on 3 years now.
God bless you. So your long-term thinking is inspiring to me. So you're saying that I'm not playing for now. I'm playing for the next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, because you never know, like, first-time founders, they might fail, but their third startup might become a hit.
Exactly. That's exactly.
So, and it's something that I don't see in entrepreneurs. I think this should be the skill that every entrepreneur needs to develop, that I should be playing for the long haul, for the long term. How can one go about acquiring a long-term strategical thinking, and not only thinking or mindset? It's just like, because a mindset without, like, if you just have a belief and don't act on it, it's nothing.
Correct.
How do you go about sort of like, how can one go about incorporating and inheriting this mindset so they can act on it?
I'm fortunate enough to have grown up in an era where the internet wasn't a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the importance of that is we learned how to be patient. We didn't get things right away. We didn't have attention span issues, or maybe our attention span was longer back then. And when you look at today's society and the environment that we're in, it's super fast, tons of information. You can get anything you want within a relatively short period of time. I mean, during the span of this call, I can, even within the next 10 minutes, 8 minutes, I can get groceries delivered to me. I can get any piece of information that I want. So the point I'm trying to make is those who grew up after the internet became a thing, or grew up in a world where that's the only thing that they knew, their minds are conditioned to get everything quickly. There's this sort of instant gratification that's a given, like things have to be that way. And when you apply that to business, it can be a good thing, right? It can be a good thing if you want to be a go-getter and chase after things and get new clients or whatever it is that you're looking to do. But it can also harm you because now you're setting expectations for yourself that aren't realistic. You need to learn how to be patient. And like I said, I'm grateful enough to have experienced that growing up. So it's not something that I had to really teach myself. That's just the core of me. But for the younger folks, I don't know. I don't know how they would go about doing it. I know what they need to do, which is to be patient. But how do you really practice that? Mm-hmm. Instill that into your belief system so that you know, okay, I don't need to get everything right away from a business standpoint. I need to make steps and plant seeds that I'll see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now. And with startups and founders, it's difficult because especially if you're in a VC-backed situation, you're being pushed to move very quickly. Right? Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult balance, and I don't have the answer.
I like your humility. I know I've got it, but I don't have the answer for entrepreneur. It's a tough situation, and I can see that too, how it can play around with your mindset if you're like so super in this like a hyper gratification mode that you need a bit of a bump of adrenaline in the next 2 minutes. Otherwise you cannot really function.
Exactly. It's tough.
And that's really tough. That's really tough to make really sane, healthy business decision if you're in that mode.
Correct. Correct.
So hot take, is Berlin going to maintain its crown as the hottest city in Europe and UK in the next, let's say, 2 years?
If we're talking from a startup perspective, if the money keeps on coming in, sure. Right? Because that's what really fuels the growth. If the funds aren't there, then forget about it. How it will look into the future is interesting. I've come to have a love-hate relationship with this city. And if certain steps are taken in order to make it easier for business founders to form a business, to run their business, to even shut down a business. What I'm really saying is if we get rid of this fucking bureaucracy, things will be better for sure, especially for the startup ecosystem. When you look at the craziness they need to go through, and when I hear founders telling me they're waiting 8 months for a VAT number, what are we doing here, right? So even if the money's there, there's a lot of, let's say, bureaucracy or political hurdles that stop the true potential and the true growth, or limit it. I don't want to say stop it because it is growing. So we need to come to a situation where it's easier for businesses and startups to run and form their ventures here. You need people to run companies, right? We keep on hearing of a lack of skilled workers and whatnot. So what does that mean? We need to bring people from overseas. Well, if the immigration policy is one where it's lengthy, cumbersome, takes forever, how are we going to overcome that challenge? How are we going to overcome the challenges of companies getting their business registration certificates in a timely manner, not having to wait weeks, not having to go to mandatory in-person notary meetings where they have to read through 300 pages and sign and stamp. And I mean, it's just absurd, especially when you consider other European countries or countries across the world where you can form a business in 3 minutes. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but let's say 1 day. And if you need to shut down your business, you can do it within a relatively short period of time. So the infrastructure to support the startup ecosystem, if that's developed, then yes, Berlin will not only maintain its position, it can become a true leader in Europe.
I can definitely see that. Berlin is sort of like when expats coming in and check out Berlin, I tell them first thing, Berlin is not Germany.
Exactly.
Right? It's not. And it's you may be shocked going checking out, for example, somewhere else in Germany. Not shocked in a negative way, but like in a surprising way. I've been here for 10 years too, a decade, and I've seen a lot of changes happening. And I really think that at the end of the day, it's basically, you know, in the fast global economy, I read the numbers, a staggering number, that the global trade went from 1.1 trillion to over 6 trillion in 2000. So 1.1 trillion in 2000, I hope I don't get the numbers right, wrong. 1.1 trillion in 2001 to over 6 trillion in 2012. So that's a lot of money. In this fast world, a story is like, I was in that notary to read that thing for the GmbH, and they got the paper wrong. So they had to go fix it, come back. And I was sitting there in the middle of corona pandemic, putting mask on, sitting there for like 1 hour for them to get the text right. So it ended up going from a 1 hour and a half meeting to a 4 hour meeting.
Which probably took you weeks to get anyway, right? So it's unbelievable.
6 months VAT.
There you go. So yeah, if that sort of nonsense continues, then I don't know how Berlin or Germany as a whole will maintain the attractiveness for startups. I mean, this is not just me venting. This is the common complaints that I hear from founders that embark on this journey and have to go through this bureaucratic nightmare. And there needs to be a fix. And it's frustrating only because we're in Germany, a wonderful country that is the powerhouse of Europe. So it's not a lack of resources. It's a lack of mindset. We got to get the right minds in the right positions who have the authority and power to make these changes. It's as simple as that.
So your background is important again. You used to live in America.
Yes.
So you are in New York.
Correct.
And so you have this go-getter attitude of New Yorkers coming in here, which is very impressive. Been around for like 3-4 years now. And you see this radical shift or radical difference in mindset between American mindset and German mindset. How are you keeping yourself sane?
Well, humans are interesting, right? We wind up adapting to our environments. I still haven't fully adapted, so I'm not saying that I have. Going back to the U.S. Every so often helps to sort of get that fixed, right? And capture that energy and bring it back here. But it's a good thing. I'm obviously not the only one that's from another country. There's so many people like that here. And the beauty of that is you bring different mindsets, different opinions, and different solutions. So it's there. In other words, the information and whatever it takes to solve these problems is there, but it's a matter of implementing it and actually doing it. That's what bugs me the most. And again, I hope the right people are eventually in positions where that they can actually make these changes.
I hope so too. I hope so too. Because Berlin has this unique opportunity to, as you said it nicely, to hold that crown. But if this is going to keep continuing, I think it's already happening. A lot of founders are choosing Lisbon, you know, southern part, faster to found businesses, or like I heard Cyprus. Some founders are moving to Dubai because they're paying zero taxes. So it's competition. It's global competition. And we need to understand.
I mean, from a business standpoint, there's definitely more founder-friendly cities and countries, without a doubt. I think what put Berlin on the map, especially, I mean, you're a great person to understand this, is 10 years ago, it was a completely different city. It was a cheap city to live in. Right. And that attracted a lot of people because it sort of had a metropolitan feel. and the cost of living was very low. And that's amazing for startup founders, because in the beginning, you need to be conscious of the type of money that you're spending and where. So that's certainly faded away. I was here 10 years ago for a short period of time. And when you look at Berlin today compared to back then, not even close. I mean, we're cost-wise, cost of living-wise, we're pretty much the same as a Munich or Frankfurt. I mean, there's really no difference. So now that that's out the window, what's going to attract founders to stay here? I know, unfortunately, a lot of people who are looking for ways to leave, or they say, hey, if I had the knowledge that I have now, I would have never founded a company in Germany. I would have done it in the US or Portugal or wherever. So it's more frequently spoken of than before. And if there's no fix, it's just going to become a thing where people are going to say, okay, we're going to consider alternative options, which is sad because we want to keep them here, right? It's, like I said, it's a great country that offers a lot, but you need to do a better job at helping founders stay here and be able to form here quickly.
Fantastic. This has been, I'm mindful about your next meeting.
Thank you.
It's coming it's coming up in 4 minutes. Thank you. So let me just like throw a few keywords and get your last thoughts on this.
Yeah.
Global recession, entrepreneurship, survival, growth. What do you have to say?
Be thankful for what you have. It's that simple. We get oftentimes so caught up in what we want to do, what we need, what we want to chase, but just remember what you have. It's so important. It's so important. I think a lot of founders lose sight of what they currently have, and they forget to be grateful for where they are. So keep that in mind, and I think everything else will fall into place.
Thanks a lot, John.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Berhad. Have a wonderful day, and we'll be in touch soon, yeah?
Ciao. Bye-bye.